And we're back. Hello and welcome to a new episode of End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM. CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Peter Wesley Salmon. What's up, y'all?
Refreshed from our summer vacations.
Oh, yeah. Happy to be back on campus, which is bumping, and especially back here at CFRU.
We appreciate the shout-out. Anyway, speaking on behalf of CFRU. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the Stephen King sequel, It Chapter 2. That's in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to talk about some of the latest movie news from the past week, including diversity. A report says that 2018 was a good year for women and people of color to have leading roles in blockbuster movies. So is this the start of a trend or just another fluke that Hollywood can ignore? Then it's a big week for actor profiles. We'll talk about their insights gleaned from new interviews with Brad Pitt, Scarlett Johansson, and Robert Pattinson. And finally, we'll look at the new trailers for sure-to-be Oscar contenders, Bad Boys for Life and Killer Sofa. But first, it is practically fall now, although there is technically, I guess, a week or so till it's officially fall, you know, according to the calendar and the meteorological cycles of Earth and whatnot. But, it is the end of the summer box office movie season, a movie season that brought many delights and even more disappointments, and so everybody's been printing their lessons, their takeaways from the summer of 2019. I think the first one is, it's Disney's world and we should get used to living in it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, for a couple of years, yeah. I'm already getting used to it.
Yeah.
They're owning Hollywood currently.
Right, so the top five, all of them were Disney movies, except for Spider-Man Far From Home, which was a Disney co-production. And then the other four, or the other five, are John Wick Chapter 3, Hobbs and Shaw, The Secret Life of Pets 2, Detective Pikachu, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. So, I mean, that's an interesting roundup of, I mean, once you kind of get out of the top five, I think it's an interesting roundup, you know, when you have John Wick, which John Wick 3 made more money than the first two John Wicks combined.
How much did it make? $350 million?
I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but it
made a good amount, but still not in comparison to the Disney films.
It didn't make Disney money, which I guess is understandable, but on the other hand, it made, like, huge sums of money, given it's an R-rated
action
movie.
Way more than the first two, yeah. And as critically reviewed, so.
Yeah.
It deserved that moolah.
Yeah, I think so, too.
And you said The Secret Life of Pets, too. Did it made its money back?
I think it was, like, around the 160 range.
So still a lot weaker than the last.
Well, it's also less than half of what the first Secret Life of Pets made.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah, exactly. So it's died down, even though it was one of the... top non-Disney ones,
right? It came and went.
Yeah, it could be possibly because of the post Louis C.K. That possibly could be the reason for The Secret Life of Pets 2 not doing as well.
I'm curious about that because who knew Louis C.K. was the voice of the little dog in that one?
Well, I did. I think a lot of kids didn't. Yeah.
Well, a lot of kids. I mean, this is. You know,
but his parents burning the kids, and the parents knew, right?
Right, but you know, Louis C.K. isn't like, I think when you think about like celebrity movie voices, when you're talking about like Tom Hanks as Woody,
yeah, no,
Robin Williams as the genie, like those are like people know the actor that goes with the character, but I do wonder, and you could be right, it could very well be like that brand was besmirched because of Louis C.K., but I do also wonder about just how much of it is like bubblegum, this kind of like bubblegum feeling, like, you know, The Secret Life of Pets Part 1 had its moments. It was funny enough. It was entertaining enough. But, you know, is it like franchise worthy?
Yeah, no, and it definitely wasn't. It was just a fun little kids film.
Right, because that's one of the lessons from one of the articles that was talking about this was like, no, if in doubt, don't make a sequel, which, you know, it refers to. They're referring specifically to Godzilla, King of the Monsters.
Yes.
But, I mean, I think it could also very well apply to Secret Life of Pets 2.
Oh, yeah, 100% to both. Yeah, the first ones were okay and worth the money they got, but mm-hmm. Definitely not worth getting as much, or at least not nearly as much attention.
Mm-hmm. And it's it's funny, too, because I crunched these numbers. Dark Phoenix, the X-Men movie.
Ooh, which, yeah.
Did you like, you reviewed that?
We reviewed it together, yeah. Yeah. We both thought it was okay.
I thought it was okay.
Yeah. I could see why it didn't make as much money as the previous ones.
But it was, I mean, there was like behind the scenes stuff that like drowned that baby in the tub. But,
yeah. Yeah.
It was 28.
Just all the tension going on and everything.
Yeah.
Know?
It's 28th for the year. So it didn't even make the top 10 or the top 20. It made $65 million at the box office, which as it stands, as of this past weekend, is only $13 million more than Angel Has Fallen.
Oh, man. Yeah, that's rough. I know it made a lot, I think, in China and other places, but it's sure. only like $1 million or something over the budget, which was like $200.
Right.
Maybe, probably a bit more than that, but not even, you know, $500 million or anywhere close to that.
And the conventional wisdom is that a movie has to make double its budget in order to be profitable, and yeah, it didn't.
Yeah.
So, You know, if you said to me that earlier in the summer that, you know, an X-Men movie would be like running neck and neck with the third part in the Gerard Butler as the indestructible Secret Service agent.
Yeah, I'd probably refuse to believe you.
Yeah, I know. What else do we got?
Poor Santa.
But I think, like, yeah, poor Santa. She'll be fine. She's married to a Jonas brother. She'll be fine.
Oh, yeah, it was, yeah.
That's quite the little Camelot they're building there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
When you think about
smart.
What's her name too?
Why
Priyanka Chopra, who's also married to her Jonas brother.
I've been thinking of Brad Jelena too, but I guess that didn't end well. So
that we'll get there.
True. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's just been like a really, like, just looking at the year overall, because when you think, I was looking at other sequels too. You had the Men in Black International, which,
oh yeah, it made nothing.
I think it's out on DVD now, so I might seek it out.
Yeah.
Or on VOD.
Because there was, like you were saying, there was already three, and like they were okay, but I don't know if the nostalgia for the parents bringing their kids was strong enough, and like it was at the period where current kids, I don't think, probably watched the first three.
Right. Like the first movie,
so there's no need. No one had a desire as much as they do for the Disney to go see it.
Well, the first movie's been running ad nauseum on TV since like 1997.
But yeah.
The thing about, I think, about Men in Black, it was like hit at a certain time, and it was like sort of peak X-Files and peak like alien conspiracy. And you know, there's that thing coming up this weekend that's the Storm Area 51.
You see that thing on Facebook? Yeah,
like kind of a joke, where it's like, yeah, we're going to storm Area 51 and figure out about the aliens. But
you never know. It could happen. When was the date for that?
I think it's September 20th.
Okay, it's up and coming, huh? I'm hoping something happens.
Book your interested. I think the little alien is booked, but you know, maybe you can pitch a tent in the Nevada desert. But I mean,
TMZ's live stream of it.
To get to the point, though, I mean, I'm not sure alien, like the secret life of aliens, let's say, I'm not sure that's like a relevant thing culturally. So
no, it's not bumping right now.
Right. So to revisit the Men in Black and this elaborate world where aliens are living on Earth and being covered up by a secret quasi-government organization, it doesn't really, it's not really hitting the zeitgeist, shall we say.
No, that was a couple years ago with Arrival and such. And it's dying out again. It had been doing okay for, I guess, early years of 2010s. Well, even recently, like The Big Sick did well, right? But this year, the big box office ones from like Jim Jarmusch and such, just
the comedies
did make money back. Yeah,
which is, I mean, it's a shame because I love Booksmart.
Yeah,
there's
some female based comedies that are still making like a lot of bank, like Girls Trip. I know that was last year, but it made a lot of money.
I do wonder if Booksmart was a victim of timing coming out at the end of May, because Good Boys, which is kind of the same movie in a sense, just like with young boys versus like high school girls. It is, it's made three times as much as Booksmart, and it just came out a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
As Booksmart made in its entire run. So I just wonder if there was like an element of timing there. If Booksmart had come out near the end of August, if it might have picked up more.
Possibly. I also think it's just for the, what was the name of the guy's film? Good Boys? Yeah, Good Boys. They just mentioned so many times the commercials how it was just a current version of Superbad.
Right.
So I think, honestly, that just helped make a lot of people want
to
go.
I mean, Booksmart was also kind of super baddish.
Yeah. And,
if I remember correctly, Superbad came out in late August. So I was able to, you know, capture on this sort of like, the reason why we took the second part of August off was because it's like kind of this dead zone where there aren't a lot of interesting movies coming out. And I think if Booksmart had come out, it would be like, it would have stood out in the crowd.
I think so, too. It's too bad, though, because I do remember it being on a Twitter and such a lot. This is the Olivia Wilde directed one, right? Yeah. So I wish it had gotten a bit more of a focus. But
yeah.
Hopefully timing, like you said.
Yeah. The other thing, Pikachu came in number 9, and which I think surprised people because of how many Pokemon Go players there are. But I think that speaks to...
It's not connected, though, right?
Right, but I mean, you know, hypothetically speaking, having said that, it's probably like one of the highest earning video game movies ever released.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not sure if it did better than Tomb Raider, which I think was number one. Tomb Raider, it's probably...
What, that we reviewed? Or do you mean the Angelina Jolie one?
That makes more sense. The turn of the century, yeah.
Oh, no, it wouldn't surprise me if this beat that for sure.
But, you know, it's... You got to be... I don't know.
Cool. You got to be in competition with Disney, and that's hard to deal with.
It's really hard.
Yeah. Also, Pikachu is loved in Japan, and this one wasn't really, it didn't really center around any, it didn't kind of throw in any tidbits that Japanese viewers might love, you know?
I mean, it could be that there was...
It was very Americanized.
It could be that it was kind of like a spin-off, like there was no, I don't remember who the kids are. Who were in the cartoon? Like they were.
Well, I remember like Ash. I don't remember.
Yeah. Well, there was
anybody post that.
There was a team of them. There was like two or three of them.
And yeah, then, Ash.
I remember the bad guys are Team Rocket.
Oh yeah, I remember those two. Incompetent
cartoon supervillains,
but it wasn't connected to any of that either, right?
Well, that's what I'm getting at. Having said that, that was 20 years ago too. So the kids who grew up on that aren't.
Well, yeah, but like you said, Pokemon Go. So there's still a love for that.
True. All right. Speaking of record numbers, the University of Southern California released its research into the 100 highest grossing movies of 2018 and how many of them featured female leads or co-leads and featured leads or co-leads of underrepresented racial or ethnic groups. So there were 39 out of 100 movies in 2018 that featured a female lead or co-lead, which was nearly twice as many than the year before. And then there were 27 movies with a lead or co-lead from an underrepresented racial or ethnic group versus 21 films the year before that. Females who were from underrepresented racial and ethnic groups compared to were in 11 films in 2018 compared to just 4 in 2018. So that is a pretty big bump.
Yeah, that's a really huge one.
I would add the caveat that it was also, you know, probably helping out with a lot of that was Black Panther and Crazy Rich Asians.
Oh, and just the success of them. Just honestly, those two, the amount of money they made, it made casting people realize you don't have to worry about, you know, everybody being white or anything like that. You can be more diverse now, which is great.
Yeah.
Well, it's also just because I think in Canada, too, our multiculturalism is still rising. So in the West, there's more audiences that would really attach to that.
Well, I mean...
And just people like my age or just, you know, younger people in general. Like, I like to think discrimination is becoming less common.
Right. It ties back to the previous topic because Hobbs and Shaw was number 7 out of 10.
Yeah.
Typically, the Fast and the Furious movies are making like $400 million. Like the last few.
Anyway. Yeah. Sorry, how much did this one make?
It's like in the 165
range. Not as much.
Right. So one of the things I heard somebody comment on was that they wondered if that had to do with like the diversity in the Fast and Furious movies, as opposed to the. Less diversity, shall we say, in
the Rock Hobbs and Shaw.
Well, again, Dwayne Johnson is Samoan.
Yeah. Idris Elba was like the villain.
Idris Elba was the villain.
It wasn't. The main focus wasn't around but, that. And The Rock.
But if you look at but if you look at like the main team in the Fast and Furious movies, it's very black.
Because you have Tyrese and Ludacris. Right?
Is her name Natalie Emmanuel?
I don't know.
From Game of Thrones?
I'm not sure.
All right. I think her name's Natalie Emmanuel. And then Michelle Rodriguez, who's Latinx.
Yeah.
Vin Diesel's racial makeup, but
he's just Vin Diesel.
He's mixed race though. So I mean, you know, you look at that, you look at that cast, and somebody like Scott Eastwood sticks out like a sore thumb, even more than Scott Eastwood usually sticks out like a sore thumb.
Yeah, and the only black character in Hobbs and Shaw was the villain. So yeah, mm-hmm. I can see why way less people were interested in it.
Mm-hmm. There was a downside, which is that. Many of the movies seem to ignore people with disabilities. 2%, which is an all-time low since USC's been keeping these numbers, which is like about 12 years. And there was 1.3% of the characters were queer, including one singular transgendered character in the 100 top movies of last year. So,
yeah, the
you can't win them all.
Yeah, I think especially of those three, it is disappointing that there wasn't that many gay characters, because that's the amount of gay people is quite high, and it's mm-hmm. People of every religion, race, or whatever. Whereas, it's still too bad there wasn't as much disability presented and stuff, but there's so many different types.
Yes,
and
I mean, so there's technically more opportunity. And I think when you look to TV too, I think there's incredible queer representation on television. And it's something that maybe movies aren't making. And
it should be on the big screen.
It should be on the big screen. And we might get to this later in the review. But I think there are some people in maybe the big studios where they're sort of leaning heavily on these bigger films mm-hmm. That are still rather, I don't want to say queerphobic or transphobic, but I mean, there's definitely the feeling like we want to be representational, just not too much.
They also, unfortunately, those people, the producers and higher ups, they look at the numbers, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably the focus change when it comes to race and gender that has more of a financial success for them, as opposed to when they use people with disabilities and homosexuality, right? Well, it's just characters. There's some films like Milk, obviously, that made bank, but those are biopics and ones that center around homosexuality as opposed to they're just being a homosexual character.
Yes, and those are important distinctions too. And I think there was probably, because of things going on in the real world, whether that's like Me Too or Trump or something, that there's more of an onus to focus on representation of women and people of color, and maybe less representation. And maybe that's the next sort of, because these things seem to come in cycles where, maybe next year it'll be more.
Well, there is what we're talking about right now. I have started to hear more talk about that, about, trans characters and disability characters. So I think, next year, a couple of years, I think eventually there'll be more characters.
Right.
And I hope so, at least.
I mean, I think when we're talking about whether this is a trend or a fluke, looking at the movies this year, we're in the top 10 for this year. We have Us. Where it's like,
mm-hmm.
yes, woman co-lead, woman of color. Captain Marvel, a woman lead.
Mm-hmm.
Aladdin, people of color, including a woman of color in the mm-hmm. co-lead.
And so, we were the ones who reviewed that. She was the lead in that one. She was very...
Naomi Scott, yeah.
Yeah, she had some power there. Yeah.
I think Mina Masood did a good job. But anyway.
When it comes to the disabilities and such... this year, the only one I can think of is the Shia LaBeouf one, where it's him as, I believe, like the father, and his son has Down syndrome. And
the peanut butter falcon.
Yeah, and it's played by an individual with Down syndrome. So, but that's an indie film, right? But maybe that's a small step. That'll become bigger leaps forward.
I mean, it's getting a lot of attention, and maybe it's because of the end of summer release. But I mean, good step forward, but we'll see. We're going to just take a quick break, and then we'll come back with some more news. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU. was a little Paul Keeling for your Sunday afternoon listening here on NPR. Just kidding. but I feel it's like it's a good mood to set as we're heading into
NPR vibes for sure.
Yeah, it's a Wednesday afternoon. Why not? So speaking of good vibes, some of your favorite movie stars are getting the good vibes treatment in major profiles. So we have Brad Pitt in the New York Times. We have Scarlett Johansson in The Hollywood Reporter. And we have Robert Pattinson in Variety. I think probably the biggest newsmaker is ScarJo, who came to the defense of Woody Allen.
Oh, I totally forgot about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So she's like, she still loves Woody and will work with Woody. And
yeah. That I don't know. She's just viewing it as the Hollywood world, right? I don't think she means she's going to like hang out with him and be buds with him. But
no.
Either way, she should just stay clear, right?
She should I mean, I understand where she's coming from because I think Woody Allen definitely helped make Scarlett Johansson.
Exactly.
Like she did I mean she's been in acting for like years. Like there was a picture of her in I think it was The Horse Whisperer as like a kid, as like a
really?
8-year-old kid. Like it was in the profile.
Oh,
she's like
around.
Sitting on the back of a truck with Robert Redford. There was that transition period where she was like in Lost in Translation and it's kind of seen as like the ingenue and a lot of people were slapping her around for a lack of acting talent. And then she's in Match Point and Scoop and Vicky Cristina Barcelona, the three Woody Allen movies, and then all of a sudden she's at the vanguard.
And she can't just forget that.
Yeah.
You know? She obviously mainly though needs to think a bit more about the people that Woody Allen has really done disgusting things to.
Yeah, right? Allegedly.
Yeah, allegedly, yeah, of course. Because, you know, her continued endorsement of that makes it less and less likely he'll get the negative repercussions he deserves.
Well, I mean, he's already
true.
I mean, he's already got that because he has no deal.
I don't think he's really gotten any upcoming films or at least
Got upcoming films. He just has no deal.
Yeah.
Like, no one's really, he's having to self-release the new one because his Amazon deal was canceled. I mean, but still, he's somehow getting funding.
Yeah, exactly.
And people are still working with him, although, you know, there are people like Timothy Chalamet and
but he's not getting any backlash. He didn't really get any backlash.
Timothy for not working for Sanctuary.
No, not really. No. At least not in comparison to Scarlett Johansson. So that's not, I don't think that's fair.
Right, and I think that's part of it, too. It's that, you know, part of it is she's Scarlett Johansson and she kind of invites these things on herself when she does, like, she signs up for Ghost in the Shell and Rub and Tug. And then she apologizes for it and then takes back the apology. I think we talked about that earlier.
She just views Hollywood the way she wants to and just kind of sticks by that, strictly by that, even if Me Too and other things have turned the viewpoint of Hollywood as a whole.
Well, that's the other thing, too, is that she went after James Franco when there were accusations against James Franco.
And that, see, she might use that like, oh, well, I did that, so like, why can't I just, you know, continue being
individual
and
just
hang out with Woody? Yeah, exactly. Or get out of jail free card. I like that.
Get out of Me Too jail free.
Yeah.
Yeah. I found the Robert Pattinson one interesting, too. I mean, just because he seems like a pretty well-adjusted guy.
Yeah, more so than you think. Just based on the way he looks in every film.
Well, I mean, he gets a lot of crap. And you see these comments, like, still, like, him and Kristen Stewart, and I think it's her more than him,
constantly.
About, like, Twilight. And it's like, you know what? Twilight, first of all, Twilight, $3.3 billion for that franchise.
Yeah.
So just because you didn't like it, somebody liked it. But also, you know, he talks a lot about, you know, finding his creative voice and like sort of like being, and I think that's what people underestimate. It's like, I think Robert Pattinson's done a lot of interesting work.
Yeah.
Whether you're talking about like Cosmopolis or you're talking about High Life or Rover, things like this, like he's done stuff that he can get away with doing because he doesn't have to worry about bank, mm-hmm. which is
he's one of those British. He doesn't just act; he's an actor. You know what I mean?
That's
like
right.
he cares about immersing himself into the character and doing the films that he thinks are perfect forms of art. So
yeah, but I mean, he is going to Batman.
Yeah, he's going to Batman, but I think he's hoping it'll be a kind of a Christopher Nolan or Todd Phillips direction when it comes to being more of an art focused one. That's what he's hoping for, I think.
Yeah, that's
he also in that interview, he seemed very worried about Batman, or at least nervous, I found.
Yeah.
Because he knows what he's competing with. And he also said he doesn't think he wants to do a sequel. So I think that also shows that he's, again, worried about being in a huge labeled film.
Well, being tied down, I think.
Being tied down,
you know,
yes.
Like every 2 years, you have to get back into the gym and get into fighting shape because you're going to be Batman again, which I think...
I would be able to handle that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of get a taste for that in... What was it? The Batman versus Superman, where there's a scene of like Bruce Wayne like working out. Yeah. And you're like, is that what it takes to get like that cut? Like,
yeah, but Ben Affleck's more used to it, right? Robert Pattinson's usually supposed to get skinnier and such, right? Like, he's not jacked as a vampire or anything. He's just average, like lean dude. Right?
Yeah, a lot of that was in the hair. Yeah.
In his hair, that upcoming Timothy Chalamet film. I hope that's still there for Batman. That'll be a step forward.
But he's also coming up in Tenet, which is interesting. Like, he's in mm-hmm. a Christopher Nolan movie, and then he's going to do Batman. So I mean, he's definitely on a, I guess, more pop streak.
Yeah, I think he's trying to find his next path. So he's just kind of taking a chance in both directions, see which one. Works best for him.
Okay. Yeah, and that brings us to Brad Pitt, Uh-oh. Who's having a year. It sounds like he needed it because he's been in AA for 2 years, and
AA? Right. Yeah.
So I mean, it's interesting that
was the one in this that surprised me the most. Yeah. I had you been aware of it before the
nobody
the
was aware.
Yeah,
that was a it's genuinely surprising that. I mean, and probably a tribute to the AA philosophy and the people who take part and take it seriously, that has never leaked, that he's been, you know, seeking the, well, he calls it a safe space in the interview, that he's been able to engage in that and better himself and improve himself without the let's say the interference of the paparazzi.
Yeah. Oh, it makes me wonder if that had anything to do with the Brad-Jelena breakup.
Well, he says in it that he had a drinking problem, and he had to, you know, basically get himself out of it, and he couldn't, you know, he understood Angelina not waiting around for him to clean himself out.
Angelina Jolie viewpoint of it too, but it's their personal life.
It's their personal life, but it's interesting for Brad Pitt, who's like, how old is he now? He's 50.
He's like 50, 51. Yeah,
yeah. So you know. It's one thing for Robert Pattinson to sort of be on a hot streak right now because Robert Pattinson is 30s, his early
30s. Yeah, it's regular.
But Brad Pitt, you know, having a little bit of a comeback. I wouldn't call it a comeback. But
you know what? For Brad Pitt, I'd say a comeback because it has been like 4 years since he's been in something ridiculously major. And
he's
Brad Pitt. That's rare. So
yeah, he's having a bit of a rediscovery period. Yeah. It's like, oh yeah, Brad Pitt, he's cool.
Yeah. And I think he succeeded very much so of that in Once Upon a Time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's...
although he drinks a lot in it. So I'm curious how hard that was for him. Makes me even more impressed.
yeah, it's... he makes that movie in a lot of ways. I mean, DiCaprio gets a lot of the flashier stuff. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's a lot of stuff is on Margot Robbie to embody Sharon Tate, too. Mm-hmm. But I think... Brad Pitt, you know, just getting to be like,
you say he's a main character in it. If you had to pick one individual as main character,
but him like basically like channeling the dude as
yeah,
kind of is you know manages to sort of balance the movie out. I think and I think that he's that's something that takes a very fine touch for. He could have played it in a way that would have made it over the top, or he could have played it in a way that was like too subtle, but he like really walks that tightrope. Yeah.
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 I also in this this one was the Variety, right? Or New York Times.
Yeah.
He just talked a lot about how he's just more enjoying being a dad and stuff like that.
Yeah,
and,
he sounds like he's taking
chilling
easy,
and taking his years. And I forget the name of the company, but he talks about the 12 Years a Slave production company.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's his production company, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's doing great work.
Yeah.
Out of that production company, and like
that makes sense at that age too. And the comment I liked is he says it means he can sleep in more and doesn't have to shower quite as much and spruce himself up.
I love that about Brad Pitt. It's like, I don't even have to try. I'm Brad Pitt. Cool. Yeah. So that brings us to the trailers of the week.
Them trailers.
So memorable. One is Bad Boys for Life, which is a movie I never believed was happening and maybe still don't believe is happening, even though there's a trailer for it now.
Yeah, it kind of, for me, was like Akira, where it had been talked about for so long, but I never thought it was going to happen.
It's like the Avatar sequels, too.
Hey, yeah, they're coming. I still think they're coming.
I won't believe it until
I see it.
Yeah. I'm in the theater and the lights go down, and even then I still won't believe it. For the first 15 minutes, I'll be absolutely certain it's like the first film again. Yeah. They're running the first film again. I bought Avatar on Blu-ray over the summer. I haven't rewatched it, but I haven't rewatched it since it came out in 2009.
Yeah, it's been a long time for me.
So Bad Boys for Life. It's not being directed by Michael Bay. You can't really tell though from the trailer.
No, it's still got all that action and fun visuals.
Yeah,
I'm not gonna lie. I'm okay. It's not Michael Bay doing it. Like, he was great back then, at least for those films, but. You know, the last Transformers and such were just not.
Except
they were not great.
Except Transformers isn't his strength.
It is and such. But
well, if you look at like the movies he's done between Transformers, if you look at 13 Hours or Pain and Gain, those are fairly interesting films. Like, they're not great films.
If he takes it
films,
in that direction, then yeah.
But yeah, but I mean, I think he's ramshackled by the Transformers, by like the mythology of the characters and not really caring about that, and just, you know, the spectacle and all the visual effects mm-hmm. involved.
But you don't really, in the first one, you don't get to love Shia LaBeouf, and you never really get no, I love Shia LaBeouf, but I mean in the film, and you never get too immersed into Mark Wahlberg. I'm glad that it's Michael Bay for this one, because Bad Boys, yeah, violence, the action, the cars and such, but, you know, the bromance is the main focus and it matters. And I don't know if he'd be able to do that as well with these two characters.
I'm not sure how much of that was like Bay too. So much as just like Will Smith and Martin Lawrence.
Yeah.
Being Will Smith and Martin Lawrence.
Yeah, that's true. If there's any improv especially, it'd be fun.
I'll be interested to see whether Will Smith... Not to say that he has gone away either, or that he needs a comeback, but there was definitely something to watching him as the genie in Aladdin that, I don't know, it sort of like re-energized him.
Yeah, oh, it totally did. You know, that and his Instagram, getting that in. That's more Jaden, but YouTube. YouTube really helped him too, the YouTube Red stuff.
Yeah. So Killer Sofa, which is a New Zealand movie. Which is exactly what it sounds like, a killer chair.
Yeah, what it looks like.
It is what it is. This is one of those things where it could be like Rubber. Do you remember Rubber?
Yeah, I remember Rubber.
Yeah,
Mr. Oizo. Quentin Dupuis. Yeah.
Right. So it could be like that. And there were scenes in this where it's like the recliner like looking out the window.
I like it. I think it looks funny. But funny with a kind of dark surreal vibe. So
yeah
I don't know if it'll scare me. I don't know if I'd call it a horror, but it looks like a scary surreal drama. With some scary elements.
I'm not sure it's scary. I mean, I like how the titular chair kind of looks like a big Muppet.
Yeah.
It's like a Muppet chair.
Yeah, it could be a satirical look at horrors too.
Yeah, and you know, New Zealand is good at this kind of thing of walking like the bizarro.
Yeah, same that in France, their films. It's hard to tell if they're joking or trying to make it very artistic, or it's, you gotta wait till you see it, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I don't know, it caught my interest.
I'd say
even more so than the Bad Boys one.
Well, I mean, Bad Boys is being dumped in January.
Yeah, so and I remember them like tweeting and stuff about when they started filming. It's like, this was done too quick.
Mm-hmm.
This was done too quick.
Which is interesting because it's the last Bad Boys came out in 2003.
Yeah.
So it's almost 20 years later.
So that's kind of cool. But
I don't know if it's kind of cool. I think this is going to be like one of those... Like, we started this hour talking about movies that people, you know, sequels that mm-hmm. you should ask yourself if this is a sequel people want. I'm not sure Bad Boys for Life is a sequel people want.
No, I'm worried it's going to be a Men in Black sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel bad, especially for Martin Lawrence.
Yeah, because...
this kind of...
Yeah.
Not all he's got, but...
sort of is.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I still want to say it.
We will take a break here, and then we'll come back with our review of It Chapter 2. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Mike called me, I threw up.
When Mike called me, I crashed my car.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Man, I hear you. I mean, my heart was literally like pounding right out of my chest.
I thought it was only me.
It was like pure fear. It's fear. Why'd we all feel like that, Mike?
You remember something we don't you, Mike?
Something happens to you when you leave this town. The farther away, the hazier it all gets. But me, I never left. So yeah, I remember all of it.
Pennywise.
And that was a clip from It Chapter 2. It is the new film from Andy Muschietti. It stars Jessica Chastain, James McAvoy, Bill Hader, Issa Mustafa, Jay Ryan, James Ransom, and, of course, Bill Skarsgård as Pennywise.
Yeah.
And this film was very much being looked forward to. Did not do as well on the opening weekend as It Chapter 1, though.
Still did pretty good.
Relatively speaking.
It made like 100 mil, didn't it?
Yeah, it made $90 million, so it did okay.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
It did okay in comparison to the previous one. It did hella good in comparison to a lot of other films.
To 90% of the movies,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
It's, although I'm not sure what, like, drove, like, and I hate to say it. Actually, no, I won't say that, but I think that for me, I haven't read the book, but I'm very familiar with the miniseries.
Yeah, and I've seen the 80s one.
Yeah, I was a kid of a certain age when the miniseries came on, and so it was instantly fascinating. But having revisited the miniseries in the years since then, the adult story is the weaker half of the story.
What would you say about this film? Would you say it was the weaker half?
It's the weaker half.
It was weaker. I still thought it was great, though.
Yeah, you're the non-scary movie guy. You don't like scary movies. So
I don't love them. no, I'm not a huge fan. but I blocked that when I viewed this film. And I have seen the first one, too. I watched it to build up for this. And no, I thought it was well made. I think you're right, though. I think it was a lot weaker than the first one and way too long.
It's yeah.
It's like almost 3 hours.
It's one of these weird things where there's some stuff that I wish they made longer.
And some stuff that they could have just snipped out.
A lot of it, like a lot of the stuff I would cut out had to do with the, like the retconning.
Well, and them going into the cabin.
Yeah, like the kids, all the kids flashbacks. I didn't need those.
That was my main issue. Yeah. And the correlation between them, or I guess the ratio, is very weird. It's. Some of the flashbacks in them as the kids were super long, sometimes super short, and just not an even basis at all. So if someone like walked in, you know, like for like 5 minutes and then came back for 5 minutes, like you wouldn't know who the main characters right. are, the kids or the adults.
There's a lot of that
back and forth,
because there's a scene where the bully Bowers is spit out of the sewers in 1989
yep.
as a teenager. And I was watching this thinking, did like Pennywise have him on ice for 20 years?
Yeah.
So then he's come back. But what you realize that it's a flashback to 1989 when he's after he falls down the well. Mike, I think, pushes him down the well, if I remember rightly. But he comes back out of the sewer and he walks home, and then he's arrested for killing his father. But I mean, yeah, there's a lot of stuff like that, and it's a bit of a betrayal of what I think might have been the original vision for this. Is like, we have the kid half and we have the adult half, and
they could have made it just solely the adults in this one.
I wish they had.
I love Finn Wolfhard and stuff, but it was very uneven.
Yeah, because I mean,
just messed around with the pacing way too much.
Because the book's like that too, and the miniseries was like that too, where it's like the kids, the adults, the kids, the adults, and it's intercut. Right, and if you wanted to do that, then yeah, you could have done that. But what you said was Andy Muschietti and the people who made the movies made this conscious decision. We have the kids' half and we have the adult half. Mm-hmm. And I think they could have done some stuff. Like, there's a scene where they're walking down the street and they look at a panel of glass and they see themselves as kids standing there.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, stuff like that was interesting.
Yeah, they could have just had little more smaller tidbits of their of the first one like that.
But yeah, I didn't need whole scenes because
a couple of the kids,
it's glaringly obvious they've aged a couple of years.
Exactly. That was what I noticed. The first thing I noticed too.
The kid who plays young Eddie has clearly had some height in the last 24 months.
Yeah. Finn Wolfhard kind of looks the same, but he's one of the only ones who is the actual character's age, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's, yeah, I wish they hadn't done so much for the kids, because what it ends up costing, I think, is the film establishes them as adults very quickly and gets them back to Derry. But one of the things I appreciate about the miniseries is that it at least takes the time that you're able to understand how their childhood stuff has informed them as adults, like the things like Beverly marrying someone who abuses her, like in the same way that her father does, and you know, Bill still basically trying to process his brother's murder, and Eddie's, you know, basically marrying a woman who's similar to his mother, who's
that was a little silly,
but
it was kind of funny. It was kind of cute, I guess. I don't know. But it honestly seems like they just quickly did that to be like, you know, we want you to care a bit about these adults, like you did the kids in the first one, right? But then they did, like you were saying, the flashbacks so much that there was never enough time to care enough about the adults to feel them same feels that you had for the first one.
And I think the first one, too, is all about the group dynamic, too. And so much of this movie is about them splitting up and, like, coming together and then splitting up again and coming together and splitting up. Mm. And that's, I think that interrupts the flow too, because the whole nature of the thing is that they have to be there as a group in order to fight this evil.
Yeah, there's not much of that feeling of a group love, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there are great scenes of that too. Like, I like the Chinese restaurant scene.
That was amazing. Oh, yeah, like, I'm compared to the first one, but like, as a whole, I think it was good. Like, I enjoyed it.
It was all right.
Yeah.
I
thought it was good in comparison to, I thought it was pretty good, pretty great in comparison to a lot of other current horror films and such.
I mean, that's a low bar in some cases, but it's...
but yeah, no, I know what you mean.
But it's, I went into this with low expectations, but it couldn't even like get past my, it kind of like met my low expectations. And it goes back to this, like the adult half is the weaker half of the story.
Yeah.
But it's also because I feel like number one, a lot of it was put on the actors to carry, and they have a lot of great actors.
Yeah, Bill Hader was phenomenal in this.
Bill Hader was great. Jessica Chastain was great. I'm not sure, like
the other three were whatever. They didn't really have much character development.
Well, Mike didn't.
James McAvoy was okay, but
he was okay.
His character had already been the importance of a character had kind of already been completed in the first one.
Yeah.
Like the, you know, why they wanted him to be the main character. And they just ended, like, him and Chastain being the ones of love interest.
Right, and it's, you know,
And the heavyset kid, who's the same weight I was in the first one around his age, or currently. And then in this one, he's, like, some huge, super jacked dude. That's so mean. That's so rude. It's going to make any, you know, 14-year-old or however they are that's heavyset think, they're going to be able to get jacked. And then if they stay heavy set, which happens a lot, and
right, there's
they're
a lot
think,
of
what did I do? What
there's
did
a lot
I do
of
wrong?
Body shaming, explicit and implicit.
Yeah, and he's away from he's away from his town, so James McAvoy doesn't have the lisp thing either.
Right, and but if some the lisp people, comes back, the stammer the, comes yeah. back. Which I
was hoping the heavyweight thing would come back too. Like it would, there'd be things.
he
of
lifts
him,
up his shirt,
yeah, or something, fun. Yeah. And it was just they picked someone way too unlike what he looked like. Like obviously a lot of people get more jacked and lose weight, but he just there's no way he looked or would be the same guy.
Right, which is so weird because like a lot of care was taken into like casting. What's his name? James Ransom.
Yeah,
who does look like a grown up version of the young Eddie.
Yep.
You know, Jessica, it's believable. What's her name? Who played the young Beverly? I think her name's Sophia. Mm-hmm. It's believable that she might grow up to be Jessica Chastain.
That was believable. Yeah.
Even I can't remember the kid who played young Mike, but Isaiah Mustafa, who's best known as the Old Spice guy.
Oh, you better believe it. Yeah.
He
looked familiar the whole film and I had to look it up. After.
That's
I was like,
right.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I thought he was okay, man. I don't
well,
know.
One of the problems is that Mike was an underdeveloped character in part one, and he remains an underdeveloped character in part two, and it feels a bit off because so much depends on Mike being the one to gather them all back together.
Yeah, and I think it's just the Stephen King thing, but like his black characters are always cool, but they're all pretty.
Right.
They're never the main focus in the sense that, like, you know, Scatman in The Shining.
Oh,
like,
yeah,
he's cool in it, but they never even go super in-depth to tell how he got his power or anything like that. And then there's Morgan Freeman in Shawshank Redemption where it's like...
There's a bit of a magic Negro effect.
Exactly, yeah. And in this one, for sure, it's like, oh, he's the only one that stayed in the old town and he's pretty much the same.
And he's established a bat cave above the library.
But he's also the one, you know, like Scatman, who's got the kind of holistic... he knows what's going on when it comes to the Stephen King holistic and ghost and spiritual things.
Right.
So.
It's
so kind of, I could see back then why when he wrote the book, that was like more of a positive portrayal, but now it's almost become kind of a characteristic thing for Hawking films.
But yeah, there was just no...
There was no love for his character, even though like
no,
you could have gotten that.
He was the most underdeveloped of the characters in part one. And it feels like, you know, there's a scene where he's calling all of them after Pennywise comes back, and they're all like, who? And I'm like, yeah, exactly, who?
Yeah.
Because he might as well – remember the black kid who was there when you were growing up?
Which is too bad.
Which is – you know, there's kind of a
– It's a film. You can advance it. You can change it, especially when the book is from what the – I'm assuming 80s?
85,
yeah.
But that's – I mean that's another thing too is that there's a lot of it that's there because it's in the book, but a lot of it feels outdated because the first part of the book takes place in the 50s. So you'd understand why there'd be some degree of like oppressive racism against Mike.
Yeah.
In the 50s, maybe not so much in 89 when the first part of the movie set takes place.
Yeah, small town though, but yeah.
But I mean, you know, to bring this up to the also the second movie, which starts with terrible – very visceral hate crime against a queer couple.
Yeah.
Which is...
dark.
Yeah, which again, I think is something in the book and from what I understand is actually based on something that happened in Stephen King's hometown
a
couple of years
before
he wrote it.
There still is a lot of LGBTQ hate.
Well, I mean, yeah, but the extent of it...
It was too in your face.
It was very in your face.
Yeah, you better believe this is the message we're getting across, you know?
Right, and then the fact that he's the victim's then thrown in the river where he becomes Pennywise's first victim.
Yeah.
There's a very chilling effect. And again, it's there because it's in the book, but it doesn't really connect back to any... Like, there's no really follow-up to it in any way.
There's some hints that... what's that? Bill Hader's character.
Richie.
Which, there's some hints that he's gay.
Right. And that's something I was getting at earlier. Where
actually,
it's
spread out throughout the whole film and it's a lot of hints. Yeah.
Which is a retcon to the book,
is
I believe.
It? Okay.
That Richie has been keeping to himself.
He's
queer feelings. Or
I enjoyed that.
Gay
I thought
feelings.
that was good. And it wasn't put in your face. It was just more of a kind of realistic way.
But I wish it was like, even at the end, it's not like made explicit
But I think that's probably, maybe he hasn't figured it out yet, right? That's the unfortunate thing.
Well, I think
it's also starting to show that, like, it's not just, like, super homophobes or, you know, rednecks or whatever that stay closeted. There's some people, like, even right. like Bill Hader's character, who's, you know, liberal and such. There's still, especially
he's
in the
show
States,
business.
In show business, so it's harder. And there's still just the constant fear in the States, especially after the Florida thing, right?
Florida, the Pulse Miami. Nightclub, yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's very true. I just feel like either it was an afterthought, like, to make one of the losers queer in order to buttress the inclusion of the hate crime at the beginning, and then to not take it to its logical conclusion, where at the end, Richie is able to, because of events that happen in the end, Richie is able to express his feelings, and it's just kind of all understood to be implicit, and it's implied that the rest of the surviving characters understand his tragedy without him having to actually express it, because part of the plot is that all the characters still have some sort of secret that they have to express in order to finally overcome Pennywise.
But were they? What was James McAvoy's secret?
That he was faking being sick the day his brother was killed, which is why he didn't go out to play.
Oh, was he? Oh, that little rascal, yeah.
So, I mean, that's a spoiler, but I mean, I figured that out in the first movie when he does his little fake cough. He goes, sorry, George, I can't go out and play. I'm sick. Which, you know, it was pretty text from the word go.
Your thoughts on Pennywise? Bill Skarsgård.
Underused.
I agree. He is phenomenal as Pennywise. He's great.
There's a really great scene where he lures a girl under the baseball bleachers.
That one is really well done.
And she says something like, oh, no, I'm not coming to talk to you. You're ugly. And, and he starts crying. He's like, you know, people think, you know, people always judge me on how I look. And he manages to lure her in because she has a birthmark, a very prominent birthmark on her cheek.
It's cool.
And that scene is really well done. And the rest of the time, it's...
there was a lot more of just other kind of, I guess, zombies or whatever. There was less just kind of solely Pennywise. Or at least him being there when that stuff was going on.
I mean, the big, like, brawny paper giant guy who was chasing Richie around.
That was a little silly.
It just seems like we have more... This movie made huge bank, so we're just going to, like, write you a blank check and you can do whatever you want.
And he's it, right?
Yeah.
Like, he's his name, or at least, you know, what he's referred to as, is in the title. Where was he at?
I mean, you have to respect Andy Muschietti in one way, in that, like, typically in horror sequels, it goes into making the villain more of a main character. If you think about, you know, the Nightmare on Elm Street movies, where Freddy Krueger is basically Pennywise by the time you get to the end.
You get Jason X and stuff, where he is just the main character, just solely focused on his adventures.
Yeah, and everything's like sort of a wink-wink. But
it went the other direction.
It went in the complete opposite direction, which is to make Pennywise, not put Pennywise front and center, but not even like utilize him to his best, which like... Just like weird glances. There's a scene in the first one where Mike's being like bullied by Bowers and his friends, and he looks up and he just sees Pennywise out of the corner of his eye, and Pennywise waves to him, and it's like this really creepy but still kind of funny scene. And there wasn't enough of that.
No, and like, what was their reasoning trying to get more character development? That was literally our main issue we just talked about, that was not the case. So I don't know what they were thinking. I do want to say, though, like, we've been bashing it, but I think if you're a horror movie fan, you should go see it. There's still some really cool deaths, and I think when it comes to the character development, even though it was not great in comparison to the first one, in comparison to a lot of other horrors, there's still more in-depth character love that you can see and get.
I think they did a reasonably decent job. It's a tough thing to adapt. There's so much to do. There's like so much mythology in terms of like the mysticism and Pennywise's origins and things.
It maybe started dipping a bit too much into that sort of thing.
If they want to
maybe make a prequel, like there's been hints towards.
I don't need a prequel. That's fine. But I mean,
it would just be Bill Skarsgård.
There's a lack of focus.
Yeah.
And I will say that it lacks the focus of the first mm-hmm. one, and that's one of the reasons why the first one is so well received as it is. But mm-hmm. we have to call it there because that's the end of the show. And if you want to listen to it again, you can find it on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. Download it from the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday at Podbean or through your favorite podcast app at iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. You can find us on social media on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show and on Twitter at End Credits Radio. And Peter, where can people find you on the internet?
As per usual, Mr. Tarak, a YouTube and Twitter.
And this was nice. It was nice to be back. It's nice to be
back.
Yeah.
Is this the first one post the break?
Yeah.
I am honored. Yes. Very nice. NPR style, like you were saying.
I will be back.
Thank you for listening to NPR.
I will be back tomorrow on CFRU at 5 p.m. for News and Politics on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson or go to GuelphPolitico.ca for my news and politics stuff. In the meantime, stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we will be back next Wednesday with another new episode of End Credits at 2 p.m. And we'll see you then.